Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview I did with dancer, journalist, advocate, Carrie Siegmund. Carrie has been a full-time staff writer for the New York Times, the Los Angeles Herald Examiner, the Albuquerque Journal, and the Albuquerque Tribune. She's currently writing features, critiques, and long-form projects for the Sarasota Herald Tribune, where she's specializing in covering the arts and mental health. Carrie started off her life hoping that she would be a dancer. Listen to the sweet stories she tells about how she fell in love with dance and bullied her dance teacher into letting her start before the correct age of 5. Carrie's story has many ups and downs, many challenges, and the way that Carrie dealt with and emerged from each obstacle thrown in her path is truly inspiring. So hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can.
To The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about being the person you really are. Not the person your family told you you should be, or even told you you had to be, or even told you you were. Not the person that you think other people are and therefore you need to be too. Not even the person you currently think you are, but the person you really are. Because as a Buddhist nun once said, just because you think it doesn't mean it's so. So, how is it possible for someone to believe that they are other than they are? Well, unfortunately, it occurs quite often. In your childhood, when you were developing your idea of who you are, all that had to happen was that someone who mattered told you that something about you wasn't okay. Usually this happens in our family of origin because, of course, that is the first place that people are telling us about ourselves and those are the people who matter the most. But it isn't only the family of origin which can convince a child that something about him or her, something about the way they talk or walk or eat or laugh, something about an idea they have or what they find themselves thinking about or what they're drawn to is not okay. This can happen and unfortunately happens often in school, sometimes from teachers, often from other students. But it can happen from information that we get from religious organizations or cultural organizations. There are many, many places in a child's life where that child can be convinced that something about him or her is unattractive, ugly, evil. Whatever it is will cause a reaction that child does not want. Criticism, teasing, embarrassment, punishment even. When this happens, most children respond by trying to pretend that they are not that thing. And if they get good enough at pretending, which unfortunately many, many do, then they come into adulthood having forgotten that they have those ideas, that they laugh spontaneously, that they eat with gusto, that they're drawn to the things that they're drawn to. And the result of that is that they don't know who they really are. As a psychotherapist, I see this in my practice every day. Beautiful women who think they're ugly, brave men who think they're cowards, intelligent men and women who think they're not. They don't know who they really are. So, the mission of the Lynn Show is to say, if this happened to you, it may not be a life sentence. It is entirely possible to reclaim parts of yourself which you had to deny. So if you think that there's something that happened to you in your childhood that suggested to you that something about you is not okay, if most people to whom this happened have the sense that there is something really unattractive about them, something they have to keep a secret. It's the old Woody Allen line, I wouldn't want to belong to any club that would have me. Not actually funny. So the Lynn Show is about saying that much of this is recoverable. And if you want to talk to me about that, you can find me at my website, thelynshow.com. That's thelynneshow. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. Thelynshow.com. In my show, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And I do this because when you listen to them, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. And today's interview with Carrie Seedman is particularly fascinating because Carrie is more than one thing. And she discovered her passion, who she is, ongoingly through her life. And she had the courage to go from one thing to another and back and forth. When she started out, she was sure she was a dancer. And as I said in the run-up, listen to the very sweet story of how she discovered that. But through a series of happenstances, she wound up at the Columbia University School of Journalism and discovered a talent for writing and for journalism. And remarkably, she got work before she graduated. She was the very first woman at the Los Angeles Herald Examiner to report sports. But her passion for dance never left her. And periodically, she would go back to dance, studying it, teaching it, and then back to journalism. But the birth of her son and the challenges which he presented caused her to find yet another passion and yet another way of being in the world and discover more about herself. That and the cancers which she has faced and overcome have continued to show her more and more and more about who she really is. This is a very remarkable and inspiring story, which you can hear now from her. So here now is Carrie Seedman. Okay, so I'm here with Carrie Seedman, and I'm explaining to Carrie that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. Now, it seems to me that the art to which you are giving your life and making your living is the art of writing. Is that correct?
It is, but it's sort of perceptive of you to realize there might be an underlining there because my original career that I had hoped to pursue was as a ballet dancer.
Yeah. Okay, so I only ask one question, but for you it's going to have to be at least two. Okay?
It's true. I'm a little bit of a dichotomy that way.
You're multi-talented.
That's a good way to look at it.
Okay, so the question I usually ask is, can you tell me the very first time you were drawn to the art of dance?
It's probably one of the earliest memories of my life. There are four girls in my family, and my mom enrolled all of the girls in ballet, but you couldn't start ballet until you were five. And so I would go with my older sisters to their ballet class and stand in the corner and crank my legs and desperately wanted to start, and the teacher said no. And my sisters actually were not that into ballet. They were taking it because my mom said they had to, but from the moment I saw it, knew that I wanted to do that, and knew I was really shy. I didn't like to talk, and I think I saw it as an alternative to talking. I begged and begged, and finally, when I was not quite five, the teacher let me start taking class. And really, from then through high school, that was my dream, was to dance.
Did you know it was a career?
I certainly knew at some point when I got kind of serious about it, probably around 12.
Do you remember a moment when you thought, this is going to be my life, this is what I want to do?
I don't remember a moment when I didn't think it was going to be my life. There wasn't anything else that held sway over me like that. I didn't spend a whole lot of time thinking I'm going to be a ballet dancer when I grow up. That was what it was going to be.
Yeah. Okay, great. So you study through high school, right? Are there competitions? Are there performances?
There are performances. I did perform, and late in my high school years, I grew up in Grand Rapids, and the Grand Rapids Civic Ballet came into being while I was in high school, and I did perform with them, you know, as an amateur dancer.
Do you remember if you liked it?
I always loved performing. I was not nervous, which was sort of interesting in that I was this sort of very introverted child, and I wasn't a ham or a show-off or anything like that, but I loved performing, and I loved expressing myself without having to talk.
Yes.
So, I don't really remember ever being afraid or particularly nervous. Performances were something that very much look forward to, because I wasn't performing that much. It was maybe the Nutcracker at Christmas time and maybe one other performance during the year.
How was your family about this?
They were, you know, my mom was an artist, and she was very supportive. As with any child who gets serious about a particular art form, the demands start getting heavier as you get older. And, you know, then it was twice a week classes, and then it was three times a week classes, and until I could drive was kind of difficult. They were supportive. I mean, they certainly weren't encouraging in the sense of, yes, you must do this, and or pushy or anything.
When you were getting out of high school and thinking about your life, what were you thinking about doing, and what did you do?
Well, that was really a major turning point, because, as I said, I had always thought I would be a dancer. And back then, you didn't go to college if you wanted to be a ballet dancer, because ballet is so youth-oriented that you weren't going to waste 4 years going to college that are prime years to be dancing. And at the time, there were very few ballet programs in any school in the country. And so, of course, I thought that I was going to graduate from high school and go off to New York and see if I could become a ballet dancer. Mm-hmm. And my parents thought that I was quite misguided. My parents expected us to go to college. I think it was all very well-intentioned. And I also had an older sister who had gone to New York and who they felt had sort of fallen into, you know, a bad way. And they certainly were not supportive of my not going to college, and they were not very supportive of my going to New York. I had been a very acquiescent child to that point, and so it was, I don't think that they expected how strongly I felt about it. I agreed to go to college, but I got into Barnard College in New York and a number of other schools, and I wanted to go to Barnard, and they said, well, we'll pay for you to go to school somewhere else. So I, for the first time in my life, kind of defied them, and I worked two jobs the summer before I went and got enough money for my first semester and didn't really know what I was going to do.
Clearly, you were a shock to them. Were you a surprise to yourself?
Yeah, I mean, that was very unlike me to do that. And part of it was I had a boyfriend in high school from junior high. He was going to school at Harvard in Boston, and he supported me, you know, going to school in New York. I don't think I was still very a rebellious person. I mean, I did go to college, and I took dance classes while I was at Barnard, but I had pretty much given up the idea of being a professional dancer.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
Because I just felt like, you know, my parents didn't support it. See, I mean, that's the part of me that still wasn't brave enough to kind of defy the world. And I think there was probably a part of me that felt like I wasn't good enough to. And I don't know if I was good enough. I really don't. By today's standards, I was not good enough. By the standards then, I think I probably could have danced professionally, but not with a big company, probably.
Do you remember the moment when you said, well, maybe no?
No, there wasn't a moment.
No, it was sort of a continuum?
Yeah, right? It was just sort of, you know, I went to college, and then you have to major in something in college. So I majored in English because I had always been a very avid reader, and my boyfriend was an English literature major, and we both read immensely, and I was a pretty good writer just naturally. I looked at other majors, and at one point I actually tried to petition to do a romance language major because I had taken Spanish and French and Italian, and I loved languages, and that wasn't a major, and they turned it down, and so I was like, well, I have the most English credits, so I guess I'll be an English major. It wasn't something that thrilled me or excited me necessarily, but it just seemed like the way to go. So I graduated with an undergraduate degree in English, and my English majors were a dime a dozen. I didn't have a teaching, you know, degree, so I couldn't teach without going back to school. And my boyfriend always wanted to be a writer. But we decided we'd apply to the Columbia Journalism School, which is just a one-year program to get a master's in journalism. And we both applied, and I got in, and he didn't get in.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, which was another turning point, because it was sort of the beginning of the end of us. And the beginning of my becoming, you know, a serious writer. And the funny thing was that, you know, there were only 100 people in my journalism class. And on the first day, they gathered us all together. They gave us a sheet of facts from a story. And they said, okay, you have 30 minutes to write your story, figure out what your lead is, how you're going to string these facts together to make a story. And this is embarrassing to admit, but I actually leaned over to the person next to me and said, what's a lead? That's how much I didn't know anything about writing journalism. I mean, I could write a nice, long, padded English essay, you know, English term paper. And I wasn't a bad writer, you know, but I had no idea about journalism at all. So I did this year at Columbia, and it was a fascinating year. It's a great school. I was certainly thrown into the fire, not knowing what I was doing at all.
Where did you live?
I lived in, on the Upper West Side.
So you got an apartment, right?
I got an apartment.
So what were your family saying about this now?
Oh, well, I forgot to kind of amend what happened with the whole thing with my parents, because somehow, mysteriously, after my first semester at Barnard, in which I got basically straight A's, the checks started coming. You know, and they were very proud of, you know, of how I did there, and very proud when I got into Columbia. And so, yeah.
Oh, right. So they supported
it.
Right.
Yeah, they were very happy with it. So I graduated from Columbia. Now I have a master's in journalism, which is slightly more useful than an English undergraduate degree. And I had a friend out in Los Angeles who was working for a paper that no longer exists called the Los Angeles Herald Examiner, which was a Hearst paper. And it had just been through a long, long strike, and they had lost nearly their entire newsroom. And they had a new editor, and they were hiring a bunch of young people right out of school. And so I got on immediately, before I even had graduated, I had a job offer in L.A. So I packed up and moved to L.A.
Wow.
And I started with the Herald Examiner as a sports writer.
As a sports writer?
And there again, it's the influence of the boyfriend, because the boyfriend was a huge sports fan. He was a baseball player, but he was also just a huge, really fanatic sports person. And so, you know, during our college years, we spent a lot of time at, you know, Fenway Park, and we spent a lot of time, you know, at the Boston Garden, and, you know.
So you knew all the ins and outs of the various sports that you were covering.
Well, I knew a lot. I don't think I knew enough once I actually got into writing about it, but, you know, I'd certainly been exposed to a lot of sports, and it was at a time when it sort of, I wasn't of the very, very first wave of female sports writers, but I was pretty close on their heels. And so it had become a time where it was sort of the thing to have a woman in your sports department. And I was the first sports writer the Herald Examiner had ever had, female sports writer. So it was actually kind of a great opportunity, you know, because as a woman in sports, I was given much more opportunity than I would have probably in any other area at my age and with my lack of experience. And I was very fortunate in that the all-male sports department at that paper, who, you know, had never had a woman in the sports department before, were wonderful to me, really welcoming, really helpful, very, very much promoted me, you know. So it was really a fun time in my life. I was there for 3 years, and I got unheard of opportunities for somebody my age. Of course, it was a time when air travel was very cheap, and journalism was a totally different world than it is today, where they sent people to cover things. So, you know, they sent me to England to write a story about a jockey. They sent me to New York to cover the U.S. Open, a tennis tournament. But anyway, I was still with the boyfriend, and he wanted to go back to New York. And so I started applying or sending my stuff to a few papers in New York. You know, not really that keen on leaving, but you know, I was still, you know, very much in love with him. And so I was actually, when I went back to New York for the Herald Examiner covering the U.S. Open, I had sent stuff to people in New York, and I was sitting in the press box, and a guy named Neil Ander, who used to cover tennis for the New York Times, that press boxes were very different in those days. He had a phone. Almost nobody else had a phone, but the New York Times had a phone. And I'm over there typing away, and he said, "Are you Carrie Seidman?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "My editor wants to talk to you." And his editor was the first female sports editor of the New York Times, Leanne Shriver. And she said, "I've got your clips, and are you going to be in New York long enough? Can you come in and talk with me?" So, you know, obviously that was shocking, and I was all of, I don't know, 24 maybe then. And so I did end up going to talk to her, and by the time I went back to L.A., I had a job offer to come back to New York.
Oh, my gosh.
So I went back to New York and as a sports writer for the New York Times.
Wow.
As sort of the low person on the totem pole of the sports staff, I was assigned to cover the New Jersey Nets, who were terrible then. And not only terrible, but they didn't have their own stadium then. So they played at Rutgers, which was in Piscataway, which is a drive from New York. And so I spent a lot of time in the car driving back and forth to Piscataway, New Jersey. And as you can imagine, it was exciting and fun, but it was also really challenging and really, you know, I was really young.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of pressure working for the New York Times. And there, you know, when you're covering pro basketball, you're on the road, you know, 8 months of the year, and it's a really, it was even a worse schedule then than it is now, because it was like one city one day, another city the next day, and the New York Times had like five editions, so you had to write for every single game. You wrote three different stories. You wrote a story before the game for the first edition, which came out before the game started. You wrote what you called a running story, which was a story that you wrote as the game was going on and then put a top on at the end to make the edition that ended right about when the game ended. And then you went to the locker room and got quotes and wrote a final story for the final edition. So it was really grueling. I think I wasn't terribly efficient at it, and
yeah.
I really didn't have enough experience. Being on the road was hard because, as I said, I was the only woman, and, you know, the guys would go hang out and have a drink afterward or go to dinner or whatever, and I was, you know, I didn't have that kind of support while I was, you know, traveling. So in some ways it was very exciting, and in some ways it just still felt like this isn't for me. And this was also during a time when my boyfriend and I were splitting up. I was on a road trip, on a Western swing, and one of my sisters was getting married in Montana. So I stopped in Bozeman for her wedding, and I met a guy at her wedding. And we stayed in touch after I went back to New York, and I eventually decided to leave New York and move out to Montana. And changed my life. I think, in a way, I was being driven by trying to figure out who I was. And breaking up with that boyfriend, who I had been with from the age of 13 till 26, was part of, you know, trying to figure out who I was. And it was very hard to break up with him and hard to figure out who I was.
So now you're in Montana. Did you have a job or you just went there?
I did not have a job.
Again, so brave.
There. I still did freelance writing. I ended up marrying the guy that I had met in Montana. Not having a real journalism outlet, I started getting back into dancing again. And I also had my son. My son was born with a genetic condition. I did not know this for many, many, many years. He had a lot of issues, physical issues and medical issues as a child. And I was making the rounds of specialists. Nobody knew what it was. They knew that there were some issues, but nobody could really put their finger on what it was. Anyway, when he was two, and I was trying to figure that out, and I had just opened my own ballet studio, so it was a lot of stuff going on. And we divorced when my son had just turned three. And, you know, it was very, you know, dark part of my life and very challenging. The situation with my son, who was developmentally behind, and he had a lot of worries and concerns. And I'm doing this ballet studio, which, you know, really was me alone. That I had some other teachers who taught for me, but I mean, I was everything from the administrator to the toilet cleaner, you know. We divorced. I stayed in Montana until my son was had gone through kindergarten, and was really feeling like I needed more family support. My older sister, who I'd always been closest to, lives on a ranch that was in New Mexico. So when my son Keaton was 7, we moved to this very remote cattle ranch. Spent 2 years there. And then both because of my son's special needs and my need to get more work, we ended up moving to Albuquerque, and I started working for one of the newspapers in Albuquerque, and, you know, was able to put him in public school where he could get the special services he needed. When he was 3, I took him to a world-renowned genetic specialist, and he gave him a very thorough examination, said, "I really don't know what this is, and just raise him as normally as you can, and I don't foresee this ever. It's just a quirk. I don't know what it is." And so I took that advice to heart, and my son was mainstreamed all the way through school. He did have significant learning challenges, and as he got older, he had significant social challenges. But when I moved to Albuquerque, I was working three-quarter time and being mom, you know, the rest of the time and dealing with a lot of his needs. So I worked for the paper, my son to school, and that was my life. I mean, so I was in Albuquerque actually almost 20 years. I worked for that paper for a long time, and then I actually got into ballroom dancing, and I quit working for the paper for a while and was teaching dance again and teaching ballet, and that's why I say bounce back and forth between these two careers. And then I went to work for the second paper in Albuquerque, the Albuquerque Tribune, which doesn't exist anymore, sadly. But I got my son, you know, through high school, and it wasn't easy. And he is, although he had significant learning challenges, he excelled in music and had played piano from a young age. And he ended up going to the University of New Mexico as a piano student in the music program there. And he did 2 years at the University of New Mexico, and he loves jazz music, and he had always wanted to go to the Berklee College of Music in Boston. And so he finally got in as a transfer student, and he went to Boston, and he did his first year there, and then he developed, I left out a big, huge part. Sorry.
Yeah, it's all right.
When he was 18 and a senior in high school in Albuquerque, we finally discovered what it was that he had. So he had been seeing, you know, even when we moved to Albuquerque, we went to a geneticist again, and she didn't know what it was. This was when he was now, you know, 7 or 8. And then periodically over the years, someone would say, "Well, I think he has," but nobody ever put a name on it. Anyway, he had been studying martial arts and really interested in Asian culture, and his martial arts school and the guy who ran it, who was from Taiwan originally, decided to take a group of students to China his senior year of high school. And he had been so anxious to go to China that he had actually taken Mandarin for 4 years.
Oh my God.
In high school, after school.
Wow.
So an extra 2 hours of every day.
Wow.
He would go and study Mandarin. So he went on this trip with this martial arts troop, and they came back, and he was he got very sick when he got back, and I don't know if it was from China or just, you know, the traveling or whatever, but he got pneumonia, and they put him in the hospital, and the doctors started coming to me and going, "Well, you know, there's some real anomalies here, like his calcium level is extremely low, and did you know that his heart is reversed and he has a right-sided aorta?"
Oh my God!
And I'm like going, no, and they go, "We really think you need to go see a geneticist," and I just sort of rolled my eyes and said, "You guys, I've been doing this for 20 years now, you know, they don't know what it is," and they said, no, we really think you should. So meanwhile, I'm a reporter, right? And the internet has come into being.
Right.
So I know how to navigate the internet. We set up an appointment with the geneticist after he gets out of the hospital. It's 3 months down the road or whatever, because it takes forever to get an appointment. And in the meanwhile, I start doing research. And by the time that we went back to the geneticist, I sort of handed her a list of symptoms and said, this is him, this is what I think he has, and this is the test I want to see if he has this.
Right.
She basically said, this was the same geneticist we had seen when he was 8 years old. And she said, I think you're right, and they did this test that they have to do, and it takes a couple days, and the result came back, and he has something that's technically called 22q11 deletion syndrome, and just prosaically called valocardiofacial syndrome, but it is a genetic condition, in our case not inherited but spontaneous, where some material is left off of the 22nd chromosome, and it can cause a very wide range of problems, of which he is on the milder end.
Oh.
So he could have been very significantly cognitively challenged, and he could have been, you know, very physically compromised, because a lot of the kids have heart conditions. And although he had this strange flipped heart, it had never caused any problems.
So, well, I'm assuming there's nothing, they can't treat this because they can't put the chromosomes back.
Well,
right?
That was part of the problem. So they slapped this label on him. Well, at this point, there's nothing they can do about any of those things. And he's very resentful of saying, you have a disability and you can't do what you want to do, you know.
Right. And too bad.
Yeah. So it wasn't, it was, I guess, a blessing to know what it was, but it really didn't help in any way. They had only developed the test to and named this thing a few years before.
They didn't have any information about it.
So they didn't have any backlog of research or information. And what I didn't know was that people with this condition have a 1 in 3 chance of developing significant mental health problems. And his second semester at Berkeley, he developed severe paranoia, and there was an incident at school, and he was subsequently diagnosed with what's called schizoaffective disorder, which is a kind of a combination of schizophrenia and a mood disorder. And he tried to go back to school and couldn't do it, and he came back to Albuquerque. And the next few years were very tumultuous, you know, trying to find the right medications, trying to get him stabilized, trying to figure out what his life was going to be, you know. His dreams were crushed at that point. And at the same time, the newspaper I'm working for is dying. So eventually he gets pretty stable. He's living on his own. He's being overseen by... in Florida, it's called a FACT team, but there it's called an ACT team, which is a team of a social worker and psychiatrist and nurses who are meant to help people with mental health conditions live successfully within the community. Long story short, the newspaper bites the dust. I don't have a job anymore. There isn't really an option for me to get another journalism job there. I start looking for another job. I'm offered a job here in Sarasota, and I decide to take it. And I ask him if he wants to come with me, and he doesn't want to come with me. And so, against my better judgment, and in retrospect, it was probably the hugest mistake of my life, I moved here to Sarasota without him and left him in Albuquerque. And he almost immediately went off the deep end, went off his meds, became extremely psychotic. I ended up, the first week of my job here, I ended up having to go back to Albuquerque. He was arrested and put in jail and charged with a felony because some police officers had been sent to pick him up, and he was combative because he was extremely paranoid and off his medication, and the officers were not trained in how to deal with someone who was psychotic. And so anyway, he ended up in jail. I ended up going back, getting him out of jail and into a psychiatric hospital, and then his dad came down and kind of managed things while I came back to the job. And then when he was ready to come out of the hospital, I moved him here to Florida. And the first 3 years were really devoted to trying to stabilize him. He was in and out of the hospital. He was on and off medications. He, at one point, walked away from the facility where he was at and was lost for a week, where I had no idea where he was. He had no ID. He had no idea where he was. He, you know, I still don't really know what happened during that week, but through a remarkable set of circumstances, we found him again. And the next couple years were just a gradual baby steps in rebuilding, you know, his stability and his life. And I'm happy to say that today he's doing great. And, you know, he has a job and he has a dog and he has, he's playing music again for the first time. He's playing a little jazz combo, and so that part all has a very happy ending.
And in a way, that brings us to the book, doesn't it?
Yeah. Obviously, he was the impetus for a big project that I did at the Herald Tribune in 2015 that was called The S Word, and it was about the stigma of having schizophrenia. And it involved my story with him and another family story, and stories from family members who had a family member with schizophrenia. And that project ended up winning a national award from Mental Health America, which is the biggest consumer advocacy mental health organization in the U.S. And that led me to apply to the Carter Center for Mental Health Journalism. Rosalind Carter, Jimmy Carter's wife, has long had an interest in mental health issues and started a program 20 years ago that provides fellowships for journalists around the U.S. and now in other select countries to spend an entire year working on a mental health issue. You have to apply for it. It's very selective. I was very honored to be selected as one of, I think, 9 or 10 in the U.S., and so you propose to them what your project is going to be. And for most people, it's sort of a more traditional journalism project, an investigative project, or something like what I did on schizophrenia. Because I had already done that piece, I proposed something that was pretty out of line for them, which fortunately they have embraced. So my idea was to reduce the stigma that's attached to a mental health diagnosis and to allow people to accept their illness and allow other people to accept that people who have a mental health issue are not really very much different than all of us. So because I'm an arts writer for the Herald Tribune, the idea was to combine journalism and arts. And the project was called Facing Mental Illness, and it was facing with it. With an E, face.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was that I would hold a series of art workshops where anyone with any kind of a mental health diagnosis could come and create a self-portrait. And the self-portrait would explore kind of how they felt about their illness or how they felt other people saw them or, you know, what was going on in them internally. And then in addition to that, they could or could not, depending on how they felt about it, be interviewed for a story in the Herald Tribune that talked about their mental health journey. And the only requirement that I put on it was that they be willing to use their full name, because the idea was to allow people to claim, you know, their ownership over their story and not be ashamed of having a mental health condition. And so that project kicked off last October. We held workshops from October to February, both at the Herald Tribune, and I did a few off-site as well. We ended up having 71 portraits created, and we had them all. I raised money in the community through a nonprofit fund at the Gulf Coast Community Foundation to supplement the money I had from the fellowship to support the project. And we had all of the artwork professionally framed. And it, with the county commission, ended up declaring last March Facing Mental Illness Month.
Oh, my.
And all of the artwork was displayed in the rotunda of the Selby Public Library for the entire month of March. And it was, each piece was displayed with the artwork, a photograph of the artist, and an artist's statement that talked about the inspiration for their artwork. And meanwhile, since October, I have also been writing and publishing weekly profiles of the people in the project. It's been a variety of conditions, from schizophrenia to bipolar to obsessive compulsive disorder to eating disorders to drug addiction. So it's been a real wide range of conditions, and our youngest subject was 10, and our oldest was 86.
Wow.
So it's a really indicative of how widespread mental health issues are.
Yeah.
And all of this material, the stories and the artwork, were accumulated on a website that I have, which is facingmentalillness.heraldtribune.com. And somebody said, well, this should be a book. And we had some money left from the money that we raised. The Carter Center Fellowship was $10,000, and that I put that entirely into the project. And then we raised another close to $15,000. And we had some money left over, part of the money went to a documentary film about the project that we're still in the process of editing. It's not finished yet. But I had enough left over, not quite enough, but almost enough, to self-publish a book, which I did not for any real desire of my own, but because I really wanted to be able to gift it to all of the people who participated, not just the artists and the people who were profiled, but the many community volunteers who helped with the project. So, the book is a collection of artwork and stories from the project, and it's called Facing Mental Illness, The Art of Acceptance, which is what the full title of the project was. And it is now out. It will be launched locally on September 1st at Bookstore One, and the owner of the bookstore has agreed to allow us to launch it there. So we'll have a book launch on September 1st. That's a First Friday event, So from 6 to 9 in the evening. And then the following week on September 6th, we'll be having a panel discussion at the Community Foundation about the project and about kind of brainstorming other ideas that could continue this effort to embrace everyone in our community and help people who have mental health challenges not be socially isolated and ostracized.
Yeah.
The Community Foundation event is at 5 p.m. on September 6th. It is an RSVP event, so you do have to contact me or through the website because it's limited space. So, and I'm a little worried about that because I think the demand is going to surpass what we have room for. But, you know, maybe we'll do another one. I'm meeting with various people in the community about other things that Sarasota might do. I'm very interested in bringing a course here that's called Mental Health First Aid, which is a layperson's course. It's an 8-hour course, usually done in 1 day or 2 days, that trains anybody, mothers, siblings, pastors, teachers, anyone in the community to recognize when someone's having a problem and to know how to handle it and to know the right things to say and the right resources to go to. And over a million people in the U.S. have taken the course so far, most of them medical people at this point. But it's really designed so that you build a community strength to support people who are having mental health issues. I'm really hopeful, although my fellowship is ending in September. I will continue the stories as long as I have people who come forward. We've now published 40 profiles. If you know mental health in journalism, you know that it's very, very difficult to get people to use their names.
Yes.
To have 40 people who have been willing to use their names and come out publicly with their stories is really pretty huge.
Yes.
So that has been wonderful. And so far, anyway, no one has had regrets who's decided to do it. I think it's been really empowering for them. And I think it's been very good for the community in terms of education and awareness. I'm just basing it on the emails I get. And a lot of people have said to me, you need to check that you did into a nonprofit organization. You need to make this a permanent thing here. And I think it's a great idea. I'd love to see someone do it, but the reason I don't want to do it is I still love dancing. I still dance. I'm now more into ballroom dancing than ballet, but it will always be, you know, the passion of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And because of my personal connection through my son, this has become a passion project as well. I still really want to write, and I really want to write now for myself. In books and get out of the daily journalism rat race. And the book proposal that I'm shopping right now is about mental health and is about my journey with my son and is about what I learned through the project. But it's my writing. It's for me.
Yeah.
I mean, for me to get across what I want to do. And I feel like that, more than being the head of a nonprofit, is my path ahead.
So you found yet another passion, and not only the passion to promote mental health issues, but the passion to write for yourself.
Yeah, so many people who are writers say, oh, I wanted to write from the time I could write. That was so not me. I wrote because I could, and I never really felt like I had the passion for writing that I had for dance. I now feel like I have a voice. I have enough years and enough wisdom and enough experience that I do have a passion for writing. I don't know that it will ever be the same passion I had for dancing, but yeah, I am passionate about it. I think one thing that maybe has distinguished my career or my life is that I've been willing to change. And I have found the older you get, the harder it is to change because you get more comfortable with where you're at and what you're doing. A lot of people, when I left Albuquerque after 20 years to come to Sarasota, said, what, are you out of your mind? You don't know anyone there. You don't know the paper. Sometimes I've been forced to change and sometimes I've chosen to change. And either way, those changes have been so instrumental in my growth and in helping me figure out who I am and what's important to me, that I'm always encouraging of people when they say, oh, I just don't know if I should do this or not, because fear holds us back a lot, and I think it holds us back from being the people we could be. So I try to be brave. I try to see change as something that's often difficult, but ultimately very satisfying.
It's a perfect place to stop. Thank you so much, Carrie.
Sure.
My willingness to change has been instrumental in my figuring out who I am. And as Carrie says, fear does hold us back from becoming the person we really are. And when you listen to Carrie, what you hear is someone who is willing at every turn to pursue the person she really is. And sometimes that meant changing her mind about who she was. Maybe it is more accurate to say enlarging her idea of who she really is. And she continues to pursue what seems to her to be her path. And if that path seems to run into a roadblock, well,
Then she finds another path. So the Lin Zhou is about being willing to pursue the person you really are and knowing that that is possible. And it is my hope, when you listen to Carrie, you hear what it sounds like to not only be who you really are, but to be willing to continue to expand that definition. And so, again, if you suspect that you are not all that you really are, if you suspect that there are ways in which you could be, want to be, maybe even yearn to be, other than you have been, and you want to talk to me about it, please do go up on my website, click on the email tab, email me any questions that you have. And as always, I hope you got something from this show that you can use. Something that inspired you, something that'll bring you down to the book launch, something that will bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station. And as always, I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten limper, but I won't.